morning of May 25th, 2020, the first episode of Sick Empire aired. Back then, there was no vaccine for the coronavirus. We were all stuck in quarantine, and George Floyd would be murdered later that day. To commemorate the one-year anniversary, I wanted to highlight the crime against humanity happening in East Jerusalem. You'll hear me, Brandon Janice, in conversation with four guests who all share a link to social justice work in Palestine. In true Sick Empire fashion, we blend together voices that normally wouldn't find themselves in a room together, including a local New York City public defender, a Muslim community organizer, and a Black girl who currently lives on the Gaza Strip, and a historian and writer who we will not be identifying by name for safety reasons. This episode is a real roller coaster. There are moments that are hard to listen to, like when one guest describes watching a recent bombing of her neighborhood in Gaza, and how another guest refuses to give up fighting for freedom, even when it comes with exceptional losses. We also unpack the layers of equality and solidarity work. I'm Brandon Janice, and you're listening to Sick Empire.
Sick Empire. Sick Empire.
To get a better understanding of what civil rights groups are doing today in reaction to the situation in Palestine, I spoke to Tahar Herzala, who is from an organization called American Muslims for Palestine. When I called him, he was actually at an impromptu Israeli occupation protest in D.C. organized by a woman from the Bronx. He said that the turnout was significant and that in all the years he has been supporting Palestine, he has never seen such outrage like he sees today.
I've been doing this work for a long time, you know, with Palestine work. And we've always had the support of community and whatnot, but I've never experienced this level of support that we're experiencing right now.
Where do you think that spontaneous support is coming from? Do you think it has anything to do with the Black Lives Matter protest of 2020?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I mean, I'll tell you this, the fact that we've been in a constant state of uprising here in the U.S. over the past year, at least since the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, people made a clear connection like you have between the Black American experience and Palestinian experience.
Next, he talks about the emergence of cell phone video footage in the region and how what used to be hidden so well is now laid bare.
Israel used to be able to control the narrative when it comes to Gaza and Palestine. But at this moment in time, Israel cannot control the narrative. Because we have 2 million Palestinians in Gaza with their cameras on, recording on social media in real time what's happening to them. I mean, I was on 3 different IG lives and just Zoom calls with family and friends in Gaza. And every single time, a bomb struck their neighborhood and you could hear it in the background. You know what I'm saying? And so Israel can't hide that.
Can you break down what that narrative was before?
The only way Israel could justify the cleansing that it's perpetrating is by painting Palestinians as these perpetually evil demons who are out to push Jews into the sea. The myth that Israel has propagated for so long is that Israel is engaged in what they call self-defense. Right, that Israel is in a constant state of self-defense, that Israel must constantly defend itself from Palestinian, quote-unquote, terrorism, that Palestinians are a harbinger of evil and terrorism, and that they teach the children hate, and that's why there's a conflict today. And everybody is seeing through that myth now today. Israel has convinced the world that Israel, as a nuclear superpower in the region, is being oppressed by villagers with rocks.
So you just heard from an American Muslim fighting for Palestine's freedom, and next you'll hear some of the conversation I had with a Jewish man named Michael Letwin, who has been fighting for the freedom of Palestine since the early 2000s. He's a public defender here in New York City, and it's also with an organization called Labor for Palestine. Michael broke down to me the connection between American labor unions and the boycotts of military aid to Israel.
The worst thing is that, as in so many of these other places, back during apartheid South Africa, it was the United States and European government that armed the apartheid regime with weapons to oppress black people. And just as if weapons being used, militarized police forces and being used against black people today in the streets protesting for black lives, so it is American weapons that are being used by the Israeli to massacre Palestinian children. The United States gives Israel $3.8 billion a year in aid, the highest foreign aid of any country in the United States, in order to kill and maim and ethnically cleanse Palestinians. And that's what we're seeing today throughout Palestine, but especially in Gaza, which is under constant bombardment by Israel. And over the last 10 or 15 years, tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed and maimed, many of them children, by weapons supplied by the United States.
Tell me, what do you know about this? The American police are trained in Israel? Is there any validity to that?
There's total validity to that. I mean, not moral validity, but it is true. The police in this country go to Israel to learn how to break up demonstrations and suppress resistance. And those same tactics are then used on the streets of Ferguson and Minneapolis and around this country against black protesters and other protesters who are protesting for black lives and for other justice struggles. The NYPD actually has an office in Tel Aviv, and it's a two-way street. It's not that the United States or its police needed to learn from Israel how to oppress people. I mean, the United States has always been an oppressive society. It never was great. It was always its own kind of settler colonial racist society based on the dispossession of Native people, based on the enslavement of black people, based on the exploitation of workers of all colors, based on the exploitation of migrant workers, many of them from Latin America and elsewhere. So it's not that the United States needs somebody to teach it how to do bad things, but the specific techniques of suppressing resistance are shared between the United States and the Israeli government. And this relates both to military and to police action, which are very much tied together, and the line between them is very thin.
I asked Michael to talk about where the fear factor between the Israeli military and Palestinian citizens comes into play. And here's what he had to say.
First of all, it comes from the fact that they know that they have, that they're living on somebody else's land. And if you read even leading lines over the last century or more, you'll see them admitting that at various points. So that makes them immediately fearful of the people whose land on which they are living, whose land they have stolen. And it's very similar to the way, for example, that settlers who conquered, who stole this land from the Native people, hated and feared Native people because they knew that Native people would resist. And therefore, they demonized those Native people as being savages and violent and all those kinds of things in order to justify in their own minds to other people what they were doing to those Native people. Same thing with black resistance in this country and black people generally, that in order to maintain the kind of racialized capitalism that we have in this country, they have to convince everybody, including the people that are themselves oppressed, that they are somehow less than human and that they're the ones to be feared. And that's why the whole, in the domestic context and the criminal, so-called criminal justice context, that's why wars on crime, so-called, and wars on drugs, and wars on just sort of everything that you can think of along those lines are really about punishing the victim and blaming the victim, the people who suffered and continue to suffer from structural racism, the structural oppression, the structural injustice, and to get people to be scared of them and see them as the enemies and as well as the so-called terrorists. The reason why Israel goes out of its way and makes a point of calling the Palestinians terrorists and calling resistance to colonialism terrorism instead of what it really is, just self-defense against home invaders, not just your own individual homes, but your entire homeland. So that's the fear of the oppressed rising up, and then the need to justify or try to justify to everybody else who's watching that somehow you were the victim and that the oppressed are the terrorists. Palestine is the epitome of where the accusation of terrorism has been used to demonize and smear those who themselves are being terrorized by the state. The Israeli state is trying to stop that resistance in the most brutal kind of way, killing children right and left, on the grounds that it's somehow it's defending itself. But they realize that support is going down for Israel. The BDS movement has grown exponentially, and people don't buy it anymore. And in this country, some of the leading voices around that, again, come out of the Black Freedom Struggle and the Black Lives Movement. So Dream Defenders, coming out of Ferguson in 2014, sent a delegation to Palestine, and have ever since have been standing up for Palestine. The Movement for Black Lives, when it issued its platform a few years ago, included Freedom for Palestine. Angela Davis speaks frequently in support of Palestine and Freedom for Palestine and supports the boycott movement. And that's why, again, you have the pro-Zionist, pro-Israeli forces trying to shut that down, passing laws against you can't be for BDS, even, taking awards away from Angela Davis, firing Mark Lamont Hill from CNN a few years ago for speaking up about Palestine. This is the fear of losing. And they are beginning to lose, certainly in the public mind and certainly around the world.
Next, Michael talked briefly about Zionism and the Jewish resistance to it.
Zionism is a form of white supremacy, and specifically it's a form of Jewish supremacy. And again, not to be confused with Jews, but rather Jewish supremacy, just as white supremacy does not reflect all white people. A greater number of Jews, for example, are resisting the Israeli state, just as in this country during Black Lives, and a Black-led movement, and yet there were large numbers of white people coming out to support that movement.
The mirror between the Black American struggle and the Palestinian struggle is undeniable. However, I wondered if Michael, as neither Black nor Palestinian, ever receives any pushback from other white men, other Jewish men, for his activism work. I asked him about working as a white man for the freedom of Palestine, and here's what he had to say.
Oh, sure. I mean, from Jewish men and women. Just an example. I mean, I was president of my union for 13 years, and I was ousted a year after 9/11 in 2002 for being against the so-called war on terror after 9/11 and helping to organize a group called New York City Labor Against the War, and especially for supporting Palestinians. So, yes, there are prices to be paid, and certainly there is a lot of hate. You know, this term race traitor, sort of tribalism in the worst sense of the word, that you didn't stand with the tribe that you're supposed to be in, the British Empire. They would say if somebody in their colonial administration or whatever, the army, became sympathetic or even just liked the indigenous culture, they went native, meaning that they kind of deserted their own side. And my grandparents came from Russia and were involved in the Russian Revolution in 1917. So I grew up with those ideas that your job in life is to stand up for what's right. When injustice is done in your name, you know, or in the name of an identity to which you are assigned, so, for example, white supremacy or Zionism, a Jewish person, we then have a special obligation not to remain silent.
So up until this point, I have been really passionate about the connection between Black freedom movements and supporters of Palestine. And I wanted to hear from someone on the ground, someone young, someone Black, who could speak on what it's like to be Black in Gaza right now. So I reached out to an organization of Palestinian writers and I was connected with a woman named Amar. She's a Black Palestinian woman, 23 years old, and she was born in Egypt but has been in Palestine for over 10 years and considers herself very much a Palestinian. And what she told me, her story, really blew my mind on what it means to be in solidarity with non-Black people as a Black person. Her story is going to shake you. Fair warning.
Being Black in Gaza, it's really sucks. All the people just look at me like an alien, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
They always treated me like lower than them. You know?
Yes, absolutely.
They are the superior and I'm the other guy. There are many Black people here in Gaza. I found that almost four people, Black people, who get injured, and no one knew that they get injured. You know, no one ever shared their story. Why? Just because they are Black? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any fucking sense. I'm so sorry for my language, but I'm so angry.
But that's not all. Maram almost immediately tells me more social trauma that she's experienced that comes with being Black in Gaza.
My ex, he left me because his parents think that I'm lower than them. And it's really hilarious. It's really ridiculous that the one you loved just left you because of your skin color and because of the culture that you are living in.
But that's not all. Maram tells me another story of racial discrimination in Gaza, and it sounds like something straight out of the 1950s.
So I just applied for a job, okay? And this job was so hard. We got many tasks, we got many interviews, and so on. So at the end, I was the only nominee for this job, okay? And I thought that it would be a win for me because I did a great job in the task and the interview. You know what happened? They just called me, and they were apologizing that they can't give me that job or that position because I'm a Black and they care about their company and the reputation of their company, and being as a Black will make the clients that they are dealing with scared.
She told me that although she was depressed for a few months after this experience, she actually ended up getting a better job in the end, so it all worked out.
I want the whole world to know the truth about being Black here in Gaza, especially here in Gaza.
Listen to her talk a bit more about the racism in Gaza.
They think that there are no racism here in Gaza because of the religious culture and so on. But no, we are being denied from our rights.
Next, she talks about walking down the street as a beautiful Black woman, and what she says is a universal feeling amongst all Black women in non-Black spaces.
They asked me, you know, you are a Black, but you look like them because you are beautiful, and Black people ain't beautiful. Fuck off.
Wow.
Fuck off, to be honest. So, I don't know. I'm just pissed off, and I want to leave this fucking country, not because of the occupation, but because of the people themselves.
Next, I asked her to detail what it's like living on the Gaza Strip now.
Have you imagined that you will get bombed or will get killed at any second? Have you imagined that you will never see the sunlight again, and you just praying all the night long to see the sunlight again. Have you ever imagined that? We can't go to sleep. We stay all the night long because we can't sleep, because we are scared, and because we can't sleep because of the huge explosions that took place, okay? We can't eat because we don't have any appetite, or even we can't go to the bathroom because if we went to the bathroom, we are afraid that we got bombed. And no one in the whole world would be ended up dying in the bathroom. Denial of the human rights for Palestinians here living in Gaza, okay? All the whole world know that we are only numbers. It's like a nightmare.
Next, she tells me the story of how after hearing that a civilian building had been bombed where one of her good friends lives, Madame called her friend and she wasn't able to get in touch with her. And when she finally got her on the phone and spoke to her, she was okay, but immediately after they hung up the phone, Madame's neighborhood was bombed.
So after we hang up the phone, my neighborhood got bombed. So I saw people dying. I smelled the smell of the death, you know? I saw bloody splashing. I saw people evacuated from their homes and running all over the street. They don't know where to hide. It's like a nightmare. I ran to my mom and I told her, "Mom, please just hug me. Because if we died, I want to be with you home forever."
After that horrifying night, she said she actually ended up going to the hospital and was able to help some of the people there who were injured. And she went on to talk to me about how she feels she doesn't have a future in Gaza because she's Black and because they're under military occupation. And she has dreams of one day coming to America and studying for her master's degree. We talked about her love for Black American culture and how we are both huge Brandy fans. Madame's story had me thinking uncomfortable thoughts about anti-Blackness and how it penetrates other societies. It's uncomfortable to think that a community can be under military occupation, apartheid. I mean, living in the worst possible human conditions and can still somehow manage to hold on to their anti-Blackness. I had to know more. So I reached out to our next guest. For the safety of our next guest, we will be bleeping out her name and any identifying information. Is a historian, journalist, TV producer, and writer. We talked for about an hour, and I'm going to share some of the moments to close the show. We spoke on anti-Blackness in depth, but before I share that, I want to play some of the conversation we had on the time she organized her visit to a refugee camp and why, in this interview, you'll hear her refer to Palestine as 48 and Israel as 67.
And that trip inspired people like Christian, inspired other Black American organizers to learn about, to organize Black Americans on the issue of Palestine. So that's how a statement like this, with premier names like Angela Davis and Cornel West, Robin D.G. Kelly, and other longtime Black radical tradition activists, organizers, and thinkers signed on. But most of those folks have also been doing the work and have visited Palestine. And that's what I've learned has been a big transformative instigator for people to get on board, to see what is happening in Palestine is to actually witness it. It transforms everything. Anything that you've ever read, including what first-person testimony or what I'm going to say, is not going to be equivalent to what happens when you set your foot in a situation of settler colonialism.
As was telling me about this trip, they began using the numbers 48 and 67 to refer to Palestine and Israel. Listen to them explain why they prefer to use those terms.
We sometimes like to call it 48-67 in reference to the years that certain borders were created. So 1948 was when the borders that created what is known as Israel happened. And then 1967 is when what we know of as the West Bank, Gaza, and Golan Heights are converted into borders under Israeli occupation. So the occupation in those areas has been going on since that period of time. And so that's why we call it 48-67. I also prefer to call it that because I'm not necessarily a fan of nationalisms. And the more that I could do to refer to regions outside of the intense ideological attachments that people have to land as a certain racial entitlement, that's what I prefer. And I also met with Palestinians in a refugee camp that really transformed how I saw what it means to be in a relationship to the land outside of nationalisms.
I asked to share a scene of what they experienced at a refugee camp. Here's what they had to say.
What would it look like if you reordered society politically, socially, economically around the refugee camp? Well, the refugee camp is basically a result of nationalism and borders, right? So this transient entity that cannot fit within the design of national imagination means that we could think about much more liberatory futures where we don't own land, where we don't say that certain groups of people are entitled to land, but that we can live in a place where relationships and community are cultivated so that there is a sustainable life. And what I mean by this, let me give you an example of like the decolonial frame that they offered us. They said that what they learned in trying to understand how Palestinians had lived before varying colonialisms. And what I mean by varying colonialisms is, you know, the Ottoman Empire was in control of the region. Then the British were turning the region into their mandate state system. And then, of course, the Zionism project comes in. So prior to these interventions, Palestinians in this region, the way that they broke down the days of the week was how many families are there? And each family gets each day to harvest the land. So if there are five families, there are 5 days a week. If there are eight families, there are 8 days a week. And that's a profoundly different way to think about the world and knowledge production. Yeah. It's based on feeding people. Right. It's based on people being in community with each other, producing food for each other, right? And so it made us think about how nation states, capitalism, and all these other worlds inform what we understand as normal. But it doesn't have to be that way. So, you know, they took us to a deeply philosophical, existential place around what does it mean to be ourselves and in community and to design social life. I'll paint another picture for you. As I was walking around the refugee camp, which for the most part, what I remember were slabs of blocks. And as we were walking around, there were kids that were jovially playing and invited us to play with them as they were running around and on bikes or alongside bikes. And as I passed one family's cube, they looked at me and they invited me into this really desolate space. And we were on our way to a meeting, so I couldn't stay. But I was heartened and saddened because they wanted to invite me in as part of the hospitality of this region. But I also knew that it broke their heart that they couldn't offer more. And that's an experience that I saw working with Syrian refugees or displaced Syrians on the Syrian-Turkish border and refugees from all over the places where imperialism has been at war in Greece, was this notion of peoples whose dignity was stripped of them, not just because of the forced migration that they had to encounter, they had to engage in, but because basic things like being able to bring somebody into their home and give them food was taken away from them.
Right, because these weren't people who who had literally grown up their entire lives in a refugee camp. These are people who had a full house and a full home and dinner parties of their own at some point, right? Well,
not for Palestinians. In Dehesha refugee camp, these folks have been in this camp for generations, since 1948.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so we have to think about that. And in surrounding Arab countries like Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, they're also in refugee camps for generations. So this is what Palestinians mean when they request a right of return, is to no longer be a refugee peoples. And it's actually quite interesting because, as we know, the term diaspora, it's a Greek term, but one of the most popular applications that has been used is to talk about a Jewish diaspora. So for centuries, Jewish people had identified with being dispersed all over the world and not feeling like there was a home. And so Palestinians have now been feeling this for over 70 years. So we have to think about, and I know your show also is very interested in healing and trauma, what it means to carry wounds from the trauma of the Holocaust and what happens when those wounds are not just not addressed, but addressed in a way that exacerbates them.
I want to be ready. I want to be ready. I want to be ready to walk in Jerusalem just like you. When Israel was in Egypt land, let my people. Let my people go.
Talking about trauma and going through it, being in it, not even having the luxury to remember the trauma, right? But actually being in it present day. Black folks, Black American slaves, Black slaves, that was also an escape for them. Yeah. That idea, yep. I can't tell you how many old school gospel songs, Negro spirituals are about escaping to Jerusalem.
Yes, like, yes.
So many songs are about escaping to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the land for everybody, right? It's all, yeah. If you kind of think about it, it's freedom for everybody. That idea, right, of Jerusalem being the promised land for everybody who was enslaved, for everybody who was going through it, that land now has or is attempting to have these huge fences, these huge barriers around it.
What you were talking about just sparked a lot of thoughts. One is that area has experienced many different groups of people who have claimed a relationship to it. It's not just Palestinians, not just Jewish people. It's not just Black folks in the diaspora, and Black folks who are there, by the way, too. We're talking about Afro-Palestinians and African migrants who are there right now as well. We're talking also about Canaanites, Moabites, so many different groups of people. The issue becomes when one group of person declares exclusive claim to the land. Mm. And that's the issue. This is where the issue of the nation state becomes the problematic paradigm. The nation state is a unit and concept that privileges a monoculture. So that's why in every place where you see a nation state has emerged, there's always been a fight by a minority, a marginalized group, by somebody who doesn't, a group of people that doesn't fit into the imagination of the monoculture that originated in establishing those borders.
I asked them a question that I've been asking a lot of the folks who I interview that do this work, and that is, how do you navigate having these conversations about Zionism in 48 and 67 and not be labeled anti-Semitic? Here's what she had to say.
Well, one of the first things that I rarely hear, which is true, is some of the most ardent anti-Semites are Zionists. And I'll give you examples. Christian Zionists, people like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Ted Cruz, why are they in support of Zionism? The notion that Christian Zionists support the state of Israel is rooted in deep anti-Semitism because they believe that the restoration of the Jews or gathering them back in Jerusalem was a prerequisite for the second coming of Christ. So to hasten the second coming of Christ means that they would need Jewish folks in Jerusalem as basically part of the rapture.
Can you really see that that's what's going on right now?
It's underpinning the Christian Zionist support of Israel. Yeah, it's to fulfill biblical prophecy for them. And so the question I pose back is, how valuable is this group that supports you because they want to see you dead for the continued existence of this state, right? And I would also point folks to a phenomenal documentary called The Apartment, which is the story of a German Jewish family that fled the Holocaust, but did so and had a friendship with high-ranking Nazis that supported their movement to Israel because, of course, the Nazis wanted the Jews out. So we have to start to think about what kind of allies.
That would be a big plot twist. That's a big plot twist to even swallow to me, to even imagine to me, because it's so simple, yet it's so complex at the same time. I can't imagine.
Yeah. Yeah,
especially white supremacist Christians in America. I can't imagine that support of Israel that we have seen for the past few decades now. I can't imagine that being a ploy, right, to populate the land to bring about some sort of biblical apocalypse. That is just almost so sci-fi almost to me that it... That's why I think in my mind, maybe I want to simplify it to money, right? Like,
it seems less psychologically twisted. Yeah.
Yes. I mean,
it's mind boggling. Melanie McAllister, who's a scholar of Middle East, has a book out on this, but she's definitely been doing research on Christian Zionist movement and the missionary work that they do as well, the evangelical work that they do, and how those groups also recruit through Black churches as well to the cause of Christian Zionism. So it's, yeah, it's quite fascinating, but...
It is fascinating, because that term, we use that, Black churches use that term a lot, Zion to Zion.
Well, this is a fascinating history. So with the formation of the State of Israel, it served as a model for Black Americans of a Zion of their own and what that could look like. So the resistance to the idea of the State of Israel was one of the first people to articulate that was Malcolm. And then SNCC, and then after that, so many other Black groups and Black power groups that created inroads with the Palestinian struggle, like the Black Panthers. But initially, it was seen as a commensurate sort of dream that they could build to flee the horror, the genocide in America, right?
Yes.
You know, as in 1951, as a group of Black organizers wrote in a report, we charge genocide against the U.S. So seeing those parallels were powerful for folks. Some of the most anti-Semitic folks. So when people are scratching their brain around how a Donald Trump with such deep white supremacist support could go so hard for Netanyahu, well, it's because those two things aren't mutually exclusive. So somebody who's had family that she could trace back for 10 generations who is Jewish wrote a piece that explained how Zionism, at how she sees it, is a betrayal of her Jewish values. And so I very much recommend people look at her piece. Her name is Hadar Cohen, H-A-D-A-R, Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. But I'm very much seeing the changing of the tide here with Jewish Americans of deeply questioning the logic of Zionism, of what it's doing to their relationship to their faith, what it's doing to their relationship with their culture, because, of course, there are Jewish folks who are not religious, and what it means to think about what are Jewish values. So organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now, people who were formerly liberal Zionists like Peter Breinart, who went to Palestine, went to 67, I think he went to Hebron, in fact, with this group called Breaking the Silence, which is ex-IDF officers who are breaking the silence on the settler colonialism, on the apartheid state. And he said it transformed him. So there is more of a movement to see a distinction. I know that when I've spoken to some Jewish folks, in particular Jewish Americans, about hearing the term anti-Zionist, one of their emotional responses is to think that it does equal anti-Semitism. But once we start to be in deeper conversation around who are the Semites in this, or who are the anti-Semites in this situation, like I was talking about Christian Zionists, or even Europe that helped to, Britain in particular, Germany that wanted to definitely see Jewish folks expelled from Europe, those folks helped to create a Jewish state because they didn't want Jews around them. So that is one of the most powerful acts of anti-Semitism. That's what Fred Moten means when he says the State of Israel is an artifact of anti-Semitism.
You know, because these are crimes against humanity, right? And
yeah, every sense according of the to word. Amnesty International, yes,
right, and precisely,
and Human Rights Watch, yeah, yeah. This time around, they came out in full force.
I've seen that.
To declare them crimes against humanity.
I've seen that. However, I mean, you're a historian. Do you know anything about where the motivation comes from? Of course, I always believe, and I don't think I'm ever wrong on this, that if you follow the money, you can figure out, right, for the most part, what people's motivations are, what people's intentions are. I guess historically, do you know anything about where the motivation for these crimes of humanity are coming from? Because surely it can't just be about land and about Zionism and about what the Torah said. Like, surely there has to be some money involved. Do you know anything about that?
Thinking through what motivates myopic support for a Zionist state, I think are a couple of things. One is, as I had mentioned, there is a mutual interest to having an extension or a perceived extension of European settler colonialism, Western colonialism in the Middle East. So the US and Israel, Britain being foundational to the creation of the state of Israel, Britain double-crossing populations there, promising the land to Palestinians, to Arabs, at the same time they promised them to Zionists as well in the Balfour Declaration and in Hussein McMahon correspondence. Let's zip up a compassionate suit for a second. I've been thinking deeply about why a nation state homeland matters so much and operates on the level of fierce defense without sometimes being able to process the facts on the ground. The centuries of persecution that Jewish folks faced in Europe. And one of the key stereotypes and reasons that they were persecuted was they were framed as traitors or disloyal to the state because they were presented as not having an allegiance to Christian Europe, right? So they were kind of forced into this category of cosmopolitan, of people in the diaspora. And so if you, for centuries, and your people have been derided, have been pushed towards violence, have been genocided for not having a nation state, what are you going to want? A nation state.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Similarly, when folks critique, Black American support for candidates that are Black, like Kamala Harris or Barack Obama. These politicians are mostly moderates. And if you're a leftist, you will critique them. But of course, I understand what it means to be fundamentally ejected, marginalized, disenfranchised from a system, and then seeing somebody that looks like you ascend in the ranks of the system, I'm not going to think that it's crazy to support them.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But what I am going to say is we can understand where those things came from, but how can we be in a position where we're critical of what perpetuates the violence that we continue to experience and what is a disruptor? So the state of Israel doesn't make Jews safer as the forerunners had envisioned it to be. A Black president doesn't make Black Americans safer, right? So those are the ways we have to be critical of systems altogether, not just representation or getting our people the same thing as the West has.
Fascinating.
So I don't know if there's money to be made, deals. Of course, now there is so much of a military industry that is mutually dependent. The U.S. gives billions of dollars a year in aid to Israel. They use it to not only buy weapons, to develop weapons, and to be a massive supplier of weapons around the globe. And that's how they can also make money. I mean, the state of Israel famously sold arms to South Africa during the apartheid, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So we understand that there is always money around militarism, around war. But I think that when we do the work of looking at psychologically why people continue systems that will end up hurting them and hurting the whole globe, that's when we'll start to understand why they defend them.
Next, I asked to give us a little history on blackness in 48 and 67.
Well, let's start with the populations of black folks that are there on the land of 48, 67. So you have a group of folks called Afro-Palestinians, so African descent folks who consider themselves Palestinian and have even fought in the cause of Palestine and have even been imprisoned for fighting on the cause of Palestine. This group of folks is primarily located in Jerusalem, although they're in different cities across 48 and 67 in East Jerusalem. And there are different lineages. One of the most interesting lineages that I heard of how they got there was that there were West Africans who were Muslim, who are Muslim, that who would travel to Mecca to perform the Hajj. And part of doing the Hajj requires you to go to Medina. And the next part is not a requirement, but to go to the city of Jerusalem to visit Al-Aqsa, the third holiest site in Islam, is what people sometimes do after they do the Hajj in Mecca and Medina. So they would go there, and then some would stay, and then some had borders created around them, and so they couldn't leave, right? We talked about those borders. So there are populations of folks who come from that history. There are some Afro-Palestinians who are actually writing scholarly work on this, about the history of their families. So it's actually quite fascinating. Journalist Rula Jibril, I don't know if people know her. She used to be on MSNBC. She is from this Afro-Palestinian community and a Palestinian Arab mom. Another population are Ethiopian Jews who, you know, are primarily in 48, as we talked about. And they have a very interesting position. So Israel, very much according to the work of white Jewish American scholars, Alex Lubin, Keith Feldman, Israel does mimic a racial pigmentocracy hierarchy that puts white Ashkenazi Jew at the top, Sephardim Mizrahi Jew next, and then Ethiopian Jew after, right? So, of course, of the three, they're at the bottom. But even lower than them, you have African migrants who've been displaced by wars, like folks from Sudan, who were initially supported by Israel during the Sudanese war. And then once they were displaced and went to Israel, then they were a problem, right? So they are, I mean, their treatment is ridiculously awful. Another thing which is quite interesting that's been happening to the Ethiopian Jewish population is Ethiopian Jewish folks have experienced police brutality, clearly anti-Black police brutality. There's growing consciousness with young Ethiopian Jews, this is what I'm told, and folks in universities who they go to school with, who are Palestinians, and starting to build around recognizing the system that's oppressing both of them differently.
You know, I think about this deeply, about how one day, if one day that day ever happens, maybe, and it could be as soon as maybe 25 years, where folks look up and they see these hierarchies, right, based on color, based on pigment, and they say, like, oh my God, y'all are still doing that? You know, yeah, like it's all, like it's sacrilege. Like it's like having a BlackBerry. Like I crave for that day, you know, where it's so out of style that it's preposterous.
I wanna point folks to the work of a couple of scholars to really look into the anti-Blackness that's happening in 4867 and in global Jewish communities. There are people doing phenomenal work, tracing even the origins of what I just talked about. There is Mark Lamont Hill. After he went and saw what happened, of course, you know, when he spoke in solidarity with Palestine and international solidarity for Palestine Day at the UN, the next day CNN fired him. So you pay a heavy price for speaking about, but, you know, thankfully now he has his own show on the Black News Channel. After he traveled there just one time, he committed his academic work to studying Afro-Palestinians and even has a documentary he started on the Afro-Palestinian population.
Yeah, it's called Black in the Holy Land, isn't it?
Yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so his work is powerfully tuning in to all these dynamics and this history. And then another person who I would love folks to follow her work, Rebecca Pierce, who's a journalist, a filmmaker, Black Jewish woman, who does point attention to anti-Blackness within her faith and ethnic community. There's definitely a pervasive problem of anti-Blackness with Arabs and Palestinians. And the power of the Black Lives Matter renewal uprisings that happened in response to state violence, murder, state-sanctioned murder of George Floyd, was that the conversation about anti-Blackness went very global. And what happened in response in the region were a couple of conversations that a lot of people who don't have relationships to the region might have missed. One in particular was Afro-Palestinian actress and film director Maryam Abu Khaled started to post videos, as I said, Afro-Palestinian, posted videos slamming non-Black Arabs for their anti-Blackness. And those videos became quite viral, and Arabs were starting to confront their relationship, non-Black Arabs, are starting to confront their relationship to anti-Blackness. Another thing is that in the region, there is a horrifying system called the kafala system, where it's basically state legislated slavery. And it's not just Black African diasporic folks, although there are people from Kenya, Ethiopia, a lot of West Africa that go and work as domestic workers, have agreements made between like the state of Lebanon or the Emirates and Saudi Arabia. And once they get there and work as domestic workers, their passports are confiscated and they're basically, they have no rights. They are forced into labor. And so they're kind of like a stuck population because they can't even go back home. So it's a really devastating scenario. But people are pushing back, which is, it's something new that emerged from the protests in the summer of 2020, is that now the region is very much confronting these systems of anti-Blackness. As I said, the kafala system, definitely has East Africans who've been exploited through it, but it also includes Filipinos, Sri Lankans, and so many different groups of women.
I asked to tell me their thoughts as a historian on where anti-Blackness in the region of 48 and 67 comes from. Here's what they had to say.
Yeah, there are so many different schools of thought around this. And of course, Black Arabs have a very different experience than non-Black Arabs. And also the category of Arab is there are debates around how and when it emerges. And there are some schools of thoughts that feel or that locate the 19th century as when Arab as an identity emerges, as a national identity, as an ethnic identity emerges. Prior to that, if you spoke Arabic, you were called an Arab, but you were called other things. You weren't just one identity. So there's a lot that I've read that has looked at or came up with different theorizations. So there's a school of thought called Afro-pessimism that is championed by Frank Wilderson, Jared Sexton, other folks who look at the world as an anti-Black place and Blackness equaling social death. And that makes it a much more deeper concept than racism. Now, the resistance to the Afro-pessimist framing has come from people who are part of what is called the Black radical tradition, which they don't discount that there is anti-Blackness in the world. From my understanding, what they're challenging is how ahistorical that theorization is and void of geographical and temporal complications. So let's get back to the region. There are theorizations that, again, as I mentioned to you, that with this emergence of Arab as a category and then Arab turning into a nationalist movement, it started to conceive of a certain group of people qualifying in that category. And so it replicated Western European systems of race and racism. And again, as I mentioned, not only was there an Ottoman Empire in the region that, in resistance to it, created a sense of an Arab nationalism, but then it was replaced by European powers, Britain, France. And that European white supremacist thinking was, although in decolonizing movements resisted, was also internalized. You know, quick example. In Egypt right now, there is a natural hair movement. Before, people in all of our region would, especially women, straighten our hair. And now they're allowing their hair to have its natural curls, and they're seeing where they come from through their hair. And so that, I mean, it sounds kind of strange that an aesthetic movement, but if we remember, Black power spoke of Black beauty, right? That was part of Black power as a movement.
Yeah, the slogan was like, Black is beautiful. I want to say that.
Yeah, Black is beautiful.
Yeah.
One of the most reproduced videos that I see circulating on Malcolm X is Who Taught You to Hate Yourself?
Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Yeah, yeah.
And so I think that, and I don't know if I have an answer to your initial question, but I would imagine that being inspired by Kwame Ture, who calls the quote-unquote Middle East, Northeast Africa, that people on that land actually have a deep relationship to Africa. And part of the European framework is to see us as, to convince us of our separateness, right? So calling it North Africa, calling it Middle East, as if they're not connected to this massive land. Now, that doesn't erase the power dynamics or the history of racism in the region. It doesn't erase systems of slavery in the region either. Bayan Aboubakar, who's a doctoral student, and she's looking at how under the Ottoman Empire, there was this rigid emergence of anti-Blackness. And so this idea that it just came from Europe, she is challenging. So I think the jury's still out. Honestly, Brandon, we are trying to remake an archive. We're trying to remake a history that is produced outside of Western knowledge production, produced outside of white European imagination. So it's going to take some time for us to understand what the history and the origin point of anti-Blackness is.
I want to close the show with this beautiful statement that makes on the intimate connection we all have with freedom.
When we all work towards each other's freedom, that's when we are all free. And when we work towards each other's freedom, we are targeting systems that have a deeply embedded relationship with each other. So once we look at the immense investment in policing, once we disrupt the overblown military budget and presence and imperial conquests, and as those unravel, people who are oppressed by those systems will become free, right? So the work that we do targeting the way those systems dig into our soul and make it unlivable, that makes it that more closer to freedom for somebody else in the world. So We are intimately tied. We are intimately connected. And of course, there are parallels and varying stages of violence that shift day to day, but relationally we're connected to because of these systems, but even more profoundly because of our vision of freedom.
I started putting this show together shortly after the last ceasefire was called, and my intentions were to curate a lineup of guests who would explain to me what was happening on the cell phone footage all over the internet from the war on Gaza. I imagine it'd be something like me explaining the terrifying George Floyd murder to a person who is as clueless on police terrorism and Black America as I am on the military occupation of East Jerusalem. However, this episode does not end up doing that, because it's impossible to unpack all the layers of apartheid in one episode, and it's impossible in one episode to understand the motivation behind the plan to seize another human's freedom. What this episode does do is link several points of weakness in our humanity back to a single source, and that single source is fear. Fear of our neighbors, our law enforcement, our government, our different religions, a fear of freedom, a fear of unity, a fear of Blackness. I predicted that in the end of researching and writing this episode, I would be more informed and more eager to digest the scholarly work and the social justice work and the politics and the history of Palestine. However, mostly this episode leaves me wondering where I fit in. Where do I fit in this fight without taking too much space up? And honestly, I wonder if my brown skin is too much of a distraction in this particular fight for freedom. It is a bit uncomfortable, and honestly, I hope that it leaves the listeners uncomfortable too. I hope that this episode opens a door to a deeper conversation we can start to have and be more vulnerable and ask more questions about what colorblind solidarity looks like in the future. I'm Brandon Janice, and you just listened to Sick Empire.